My name is Lexi Doyle, and I am currently a first-year medical student. Today, I'm very excited to share with you a conversation I had with a phenomenal person, scholar, and disability advocate, Paki Toscano. In addition to receiving numerous honors recognizing his scholarship and service, Paki has also published in both scholarly and journalistic outlets on the topics of disability in early modern English literature, which are now the foci of his work as a doctoral student at Princeton. Importantly, in addition to all these extraordinary achievements, Paki is a remarkable friend. Through our friendship, I have not only experienced his profound care and compassion, but I have also learned immense amounts about the topic of disability. His generous and articulate sharing of his experiences and insights have significantly shaped my learning, both as a person and medical student, and have expanded my understanding of disability and advocacy. In this conversation, Paki was kind enough to discuss his experiences in the medical system following his spinal cord injury and share his reflections on the current moment in which we find ourselves due to the COVID-19 pandemic in relation to both his experiences and work surrounding disability. It is my hope that this conversation will put on the record a fraction of Paki's wisdom and insight. So, with that, welcome, Paki.
Thank you so much, Alexis. I so appreciate that very kind introduction. And just for anyone listening, I would like to add that I consider you to be a great role model for me. And I think it's so important for people who are working on both the side of advocacy, especially regarding the disabled population or disabled populations, depending on how you want to think about it, and people on the side of medicine to collaborate and communicate and have these really productive conversations about topics that are incredibly germane to both of to what we think both think about and do on a regular basis.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for being here and being so committed to helping other people learn from your own experience in your thinking. So to start off, people listening to this podcast probably don't know your story. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you've gotten involved in the work you're involved in today?
Of course. Thank you so much for the opportunity to say more. So when I was 19, I came home from college for the summer, and I was riding my bicycle with my father. We were about 2 minutes away from the house when we were crossing a road, and a truck hit me. I mean, it was as instantaneous and it was as simple as that. Of course, the consequences weren't simple at all, but the incident itself flew by in just a few seconds. I was struck down from my bicycle, of course. Interestingly enough, the bicycle made it through fairly unscathed. My father has ridden this since. I, on the other hand, had a lumbar burst. One of my vertebrae had shattered in my back. And as a result of that, I was instantaneously paralyzed below the waist. So I had no feeling whatsoever. I was on an incredibly hot blacktop from the sun. This was July 5th, so one day after the 4th of July. And, you know, it was like the lights going off in a storm. One moment I could see, the next moment I couldn't. Similarly, one moment, you know, I could feel, I was moving. The next minute I was on the ground, my legs sprawled out beside me or in front of me, as if they were dead weights. People started gathering around. They had to stop traffic. An ambulance, of course, came. And I remember being hysterical. I mean, you know, I'm somewhat of a calm person under normal circumstances, I'd like to believe. But, you know, nothing quite prepares you for an experience like that. And an experience of radically altering what you think you know about your body and how you embody and experience the world. So I was taken to the hospital. They were unable to do surgery at the local facility, which was about 15 minutes away. So they drove me again in an ambulance to Cincinnati that evening, so to the University of Cincinnati, which was more, more suited to my particular needs and my particular health history. To make matters more complicated, I had osteopenia, and I still do, which has only been exacerbated since the accident because of all the time I spent lying and immobile and not weight-bearing. So I was brought to brought to the UC main hospital. And the next day, I received a fusion. So the two vertebrae above L1 and the two vertebrae below were fused together. And after that, I experienced a further month of inpatient therapy and another 6 months of focused outpatient therapy for 3 to 4 times a week. And I slowly went from using a wheelchair to using a walker, and that took about, 2.5 months, 3 months. And then I eventually progressed to the cane. This happened in July, and I think by late November, I was using a cane somewhat hesitantly, not without a gait belt, not without someone always accompanying me. Eventually I went back to college in January. I took a semester off to really focus on my rehabilitation. And in January, I went back to college. And at that point, I was using a cane full time. That's not to say that I haven't gone back to the walker and even the wheelchair as different situations presented themselves. One of the things about having any chronic illness, but especially a spinal cord injury, is that the chances of you having other injuries are incredibly high. Many, many people with spinal cord injuries experience another spinal cord injury at some point in their lives. And luckily for me, that has not happened, although I have had, I did break my kneecap last year. And those are the kinds of things you have to be able to expect and adapt to with something like a spinal cord injury.
Thank you so much for sharing all of that.
Of course, of course. I think it's important to talk about this and to not feel that we have to keep it to ourselves and to not be embarrassed about these sort of medical experiences.
Absolutely. I want to ask you and follow up about a couple things that you said. One of the things that you said was the initial experience of the spinal cord injury changed your understanding of your body. Could you speak a little more to that?
Yeah. I mean, I'm glad you picked up on that, because I think that's a really important point to take away from any kind of story about disability, but especially one that involves a traumatic injury, right? Some disabilities, evolve gradually over time. I'm an early modern literature sort of professor in training, let's say, and I study John Milton, who went blind from 1654 to 1652, and that was a gradual process. It wasn't that he woke up one day and went blind, and that's true of many sensory impairments. I mean, many people who experience vision deficits or who are hearing impaired lose more over time. I'm also hearing impaired, and that's an experience that I am bracing myself for. In the case of a traumatic injury, like a spinal cord injury, you have no warning, you have no preparation. And at the time, I was a 19-year-old. I was never super athletic. I was nothing like you, Lexi, but I was active. I played tennis every day in the summer and in the spring. I was just a year out from being a 4-year varsity letterer in high school in the sport. I swam. I rode my bicycle. Obviously, that's what happened when that's what led to the accident, in a sense. And so I had a particular idea of what my body could do and what my body would always do, or at least for the foreseeable future. I had some distant inclination that by the time I hit Medicare age or started collecting Social Security checks, that eventually things might change. And I had grandparents that sort of show me what that looked like, but I had no role models whatsoever. And this is, leads to a larger conversation about cultural representation of disability. But I had no role models whatsoever for what it looked like for someone who's 19, who goes to college in an incredibly hilly place in the Shenandoah Valley, for someone who was just beginning to have a taste of independence, what it means for someone in that position to suddenly not be able to walk. This is someone too who thought of wheelchair users as wheelchair bound, as someone who still used the word invalid, as someone who still used the word lame, with all of the sort of connotations that language brings. And so I had no sense of what a disabled life might look like, other than to know that it meant being quote unquote a shut-in, as you see in literature and language from 50, 100 years ago.
Wow. And for those of you who don't know Pocky, he is an early modern English literature scholar. And I always just take delight in the ways you're able to draw parallels and resonances with the written word from so long ago with what we're still navigating today. It's very impressive. Thank you for sharing all of that. Another thing I wanted to pick up on from when you were explaining your journey to today is how having a spinal cord injury and having subsequent injuries has caused you to need to be very adaptable. Mm-hmm. Could you go into a little bit more about how you think about what it means to be adaptable and how it relates to your life?
Of course. I think that's crucial. I mean, I always say that part of living as a disabled individual is learning and living with constant problem-solving capacities, right? So, you know, you are in almost incessantly facing barriers that you then have to find a way around or over or not. I mean, and this is the sad truth, is that the ADA has been passed, you know, almost 30 years ago, and yet there are still constant barriers. Now, when I wake up in the morning, what does that look like? You know, the idea of adaptability begins then. I get up, I go into the bathroom, we have bars, you know, handlebars on the toilet, so I can, it helps me get up and down from the commode. And then we have a shower chair. And so I sit on that. You know, it's hard for me to even remember what it was like to stand while taking a shower. I mean, that's how quickly things, you begin to sort of rethink what your life looks like. Although it's not an easy process. It happens somewhat quickly if you're lucky, but it's not without serious emotional turbulence. So those are sort of the two easy examples. Of course, you know, being able to toggle back and forth between a cane, between a walker, between a wheelchair, and doing so with a certain degree of preparedness and a certain degree of grace, let's say, of not being totally devastated by having to move from one ambulatory device to the next is also, I think, an incredibly important skill, because you never know when your situation is going to change or when the built environment around you is going to change. And this gets into issues about how disability, about how impairment, which is the medical sort of fact of there being something diagnosably different about you, how that fact parlays itself into a disability. It's by not having the resources to purchase adaptive equipment. It's by not having the wherewithal, the knowledge of what to get. And it's because of the fact that society is incredibly intransigent on this front. People don't want to pay money to comply with the ADA. And people are hesitant because they think that disabled people are far and few between. Why build a ramp or why put in an elevator if no one uses it? When in fact, we know that disabled individuals account for about 1 in 5 of the American population.
You've hit on so many things I'd want to dive deeper into. I think, first of all, your thoughts and sharing about how impairment is a very different concept than disability. And I think sometimes in medical environments, those two terms are collapsed. But really, it's important, like you said, to recognize the difference that a disability is realized in the context of an environment into which an impairment is introduced. And thinking about that, certainly the COVID-19 crisis has created additional barriers for those with disability to access medical care and essential services in many instances. However, we've also seen universities move to be completely online, businesses permitting employees to work from home, and restaurants adapting to more takeout availability. And for many people, these accommodations would make learning, working, and living more accessible absent a crisis.
Yes.
Not to mention, disability advocates, like you referenced, have been pushing for these accommodations for decades in order to facilitate more inclusive participation in the day-to-day activities that our communities partake in. So how have you been thinking about the accommodations that schools, workplaces, and other institutions have been making during this pandemic?
I think that's an astute observation, and I think it's one that will hopefully change the way that employers think about how they might include disabled employees in their workplace communities. This is a situation that is not unusual, and it's not foreign to people like me who have spent considerable amounts of time in something akin to a quarantine, because we had no choice but to do just that. When I had my, when I broke my kneecap last year, I was unable to activate my quadriceps. for fear that it would tear the kneecap back apart, which in fact it did once, which is maybe another story we could go into, because I think that was an unnecessary development and one that was due to a lack of medical oversight and accountability. But, you know, the larger point that I'm trying to make is that we're seeing a moment that foregrounds the fluidity and flexibility of the idea of disability, right? And that means, what I mean by that is people who have never experienced disability, who would never think of themselves as disabled, save for a short period while a broken bone is healing or while an outpatient surgery is being, you know, overcome. Save those moments, many of the people now sitting at home and bored out of their minds and complaining and protesting at the Michigan State House for completely inane reasons and dangerous reasons in a dangerous way. For all those people wondering what life can be while home, I say, talk to one of your disabled friends. And if they don't have any disabled friends, that's just a sign of how isolated many disabled people still are in our society. So my point would be that if this shows us nothing else, is that complaints about rendering spaces and rendering workplace relationships accessible are red herrings for something else. And that something else is discomfort. It's ableism, pure and simple. It's fear. It's concerns about liability. What happens when someone who's disabled keels over on the job? Because all disabled people must obviously be weak and you know, enervated and all of these things, when nothing could be further from the truth. So you know, we talk about accessibility, and in some ways it's a non-political issue, right? Everyone, you know, Republicans, conservatives, liberals, Democrats alike love to talk about what they're doing for the disabled community. But when it comes right down to it, what both sides of the aisle fail to recognize is that when the chips are down, accommodations are made for the general population that would never be made for disabled individuals.
Wow, that was so powerful, everything you said. And I think highlighting the discomfort, fear, and liability, like you said, is really important, because those emotions about disabled people, disabled bodies, really are the fuel behind these completely inaccurate and shaming and unhelpful narratives that we have about disability. I'm wondering, you know, since you've done so much work really exploring how these narratives and disability manifest in literature, but you've also experienced them in your life, could you speak to times where you've come up in a very practical way against one of these narratives?
Yes. So I think one of the narratives that is not just a narrative, that disabled people have to struggle with, but it's also one that anyone in a sort of, you know, belonging to a minority deals with, is the idea that they have achieved something simply because of that minority status. And so, you know, and I think this, you know, before I share the story, I just want to highlight the fact that many of the issues we're talking about vis-a-vis disability are also incredibly important to other marginalized demographics, right? So when we talk about working from home, right, for years people have said that, you know, women can't enter the workplace because they're divided between familial commitments and workplace commitments, and how could they ever possibly balance the two, right? And now suddenly, you know, we're accepting the fact that people are balancing the two in very real ways, with homeschooling, with you know, making food for children, and all these things. So those complaints that were often levied against certain populations, you know, 50, 60 years ago, are now, you know, they're really being shown for the hollow sort of chauvinistic, bigoted, you know, straw man arguments that they were. But I think that's important. I think realizing the intersectionality of these issues is incredibly key. I mean, we talk about intersectionality a lot when it comes to feminism, but it's important to realize that many of the ways that marginalized groups have become marginalized is through the language and rhetoric of disability. Okay, so I just wanted to mention that so we can sort of bracket it for later in the conversation if we would like to return. But after being awarded the Rhodes Scholarship, which you mentioned earlier, I was having a conversation with a professor in the hallway one day at the university where I attended, and the professor looked at me and with a smirk on his face said, "Now that you're, you know, a Rhodes Scholar, are you going to throw away your cane and your brace?" And this, I mean, this is a sort of horrifying notion for a couple of reasons. One, it plays into the more general and banal point, banal but not unimportant or not, you know, severely damaging to sort of the careers of many people, that you know, individuals in sort of hegemonic demographics are very quick to dismiss the achievements of people outside of those groups. But I also think it taps into a larger sort of stereotype about disability, which is that the disabled can sort of activate this immense pity within able-bodied individuals. And in fact, for a long time, that's how able-bodied and disabled people interacted with one another. It was really formed and structured along the lines of the affect of pity. And that's a really damning trope. There's also the trope, of course, of the super crip, right? Which is the disabled individual who has superpowers precisely because of her or his disability. And so if you think, you know, if you open any one of a number of superhero novels or comic books or look at a movie, you're going to see this almost immediately. And I think all of those discourses are sort of being funneled into that conversation that I had with that professor, who was assuming that the cane and the brace were props, were prosthetics that enabled me to get ahead in some way. And you know, certainly my disability is an important, it informs what I do and what I think about and how I interact in the world in important ways. And I'm sure that, you know, disability factors in to conversations about, you know, cultivating diverse groups of scholars or students or, you know, employees. And it should, right? We don't want disability to be discounted. But what we also don't want is people attributing achievement to disability. It's not the fact of someone being disabled or a woman or Black. In many cases, it can be about how the person responds to the challenges of being in those marginalized groups. And one of those challenges is the conversation that I had. So, I mean, you can see the circularity of the logic.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing that anecdote. I do want to tap back into what you had bracketed about the similarities that we can see and experience or even observe if you're not a part of a marginalized group between the experiences of people in marginalized groups. And what you were saying about women reminded me of how narratives we have about what type of identities are fit for certain roles in our society die very hard. Mm-hmm. And for a while, you know, the narrative about who is a doctor was that a doctor is a white man, right? And we've seen that expand in progressive and more inclusive ways. But it's not to say that, you know, people of color, women, disabled individuals don't still encounter real challenges in working environments where the roles were so entrenched and attached to a certain identity. Yeah. And I'm wondering, now that we're in this moment where I think you said intransigent nature of society is being proven to be not really true, not really substantive with respect to making accommodations for workers and whatnot, do you have any hopes for things that we might as a society realize coming out of this pandemic about our understandings of people who could keep using these accommodations to learn, to work, or could even benefit from other forms of flexibility in how we interact and live together?
I think that's a great question. I think that being, you know, I am not saying that we want work, that we want companies to dissolve sort of their, you know, get away from having a sort of centralized place for people to work together. I think there's a great benefit for people to be in the same spaces and for people to be working face to face. I think that's important as a society and as people, that human contact. I think what I am very hopeful about is that we can realize, we can reconceptualize what intimacy between humans might look like. And I think, you know, so often I struggled with the sense that I was being a bit needy after both accidents, with, you know, wanting to talk to people on the phone, wanting to FaceTime people, wanting to text people. And I think, you know, many of the folks with whom I'm closest didn't exactly get how isolating it can be at home. And I think what we're seeing now is people are emphasizing the importance of reaching out electronically and using technology to bridge those divides. And I think especially for, you know, many men who are making friendships that are, you know, very activity-based or oriented towards who's around at convenient moments, I think it's forcing them to rethink what it means to be in a relationship, to be in a platonic relationship, or in a romantic one for that matter. So that's what I'm most hopeful about, is that coming out of this, we won't be so quick to label people who are good about keeping in touch, or who demand a sort of, not demand, but who prioritize a sort of regular communication, that we won't label those people as needy, because that idea of neediness is one that has deleteriously affected the disabled population for a long time. It's one that comes through when we talk about the so-called welfare queen. It's one that comes through when we talk about abuses of disability, entitlements, and that neediness that we seem to attribute as a way of villainizing disabled people and saying that they're just that they're just, you know, sucking dry the resources of the able-bodied population, is one that I'm hopeful will go out the window. I'm also hopeful, of course, that employers will be more amenable, and not just amenable, but see it as necessary to be adaptive when thinking about the right sort of workplace configuration and workplace sort of accommodations for each individual person. I think that's what we've seen, that people are saying, this is not going to work for me right now to go into the office or to go into the field or go into whatever context they're going. And some employers are forcing people to do things that are uncomfortable for them. But I think realizing, you know, reintroducing comfort and reintroducing personal needs into the American sort of capitalistic regime is an important one that we're only just now realizing.
Have you experienced any of these flawed or unproductive narratives we've been discussing about disability as you've received your medical care?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the biggest issue when you're in the hospital is the sort of models of disability that are operative, right? So just kind of a disability study. I mean, and any disability theorist worth her or his salt could do this, right? So this isn't me being special, but it's me recognizing that we are all coming at this issue from different perspectives and with different sort of knowledge bases. So the sort of dominant model of disability in disability communities is something called the social model of disability. So that's the idea that disability and impairment are different. Impairment is a sort of corporeal fact or corporeal state, and disability is a socially constructed barrier to impaired people's full involvement in the world, in society, in their communities. The model of disability that's operative in most hospitals and most rehabilitation centers is something called the medical model of disability, which is that disability, there is no such thing as disability versus impairment. What you have is something that is inherently bad and must be cured at any cost. And that cost may involve, you know, great strain upon you. It may involve the danger, other sort of dangers or side effects to the disabled individual. But what I found in different hospital settings is that people aren't too concerned about that. What they're concerned with is getting you, quote unquote, healthy and getting you cured. And I think the idea that disability can't be a sort of beneficial epistemological resource, or it can't instill within you a sort of new worldview, is really, really problematic and troubling. And it leads, I mean, quite frankly, it leads to sort of an impoverished sense of how to best help disabled people, right? I mean, if medical professionals were willing to admit that their strategies aren't always the best or aren't always the strategies that disabled individuals might want to go with, or their way of thinking about disability might not be the way that disabled the patient herself or himself thinks about disability, then a whole range of sort of treatment plans might open up. And I think that's really important. Now, I'm not saying, of course, I'm not saying that you don't go to the doctor if you have a spinal cord injury or you don't have surgery or you don't get physical therapy, you don't undergo occupational therapy. That's not what I'm saying. I mean, that would be an incomment to make. And of course, I've done all these things. I wear a brace. I use a cane. It's not that I am opposed or villainized medical intervention. Some of my best friends, some of the people I care most about in the world, like Lexi, like other mutual friends that we have, are in medical school right now. I think doctors are in a unique position to do immense good in disabled people's lives. And in fact, there are doctors doing immense good in disabled people's lives. But I think there are a couple assumptions that as physicians, y'all can't accept as givens. And those are the fact that the patient before you is conceiving of their chronic illness or disability as inherently terrible and that is something that must be cured. And I think the other thing is the fact that disabled people have to be cared for or pitied or treated as children, right? And this is tapping into a number of other models, such as the charity model of disability, or that would be the big one of treating disabled people as needing the intervention of able-bodied people, right? Ideally, the relationship between a disabled person and a healthcare professional or provider would be a partnership, and it would not be one person pitying or bestowing charity upon the other. Now, an example of that, for instance, is that when I was in the hospital after the spinal cord injury, and I actually have many more grouses with how the kneecap injury was handled, so we can go there if we want to, but the sort of basic response I had to Lexi's question, and then I'll let her ask another, is that when the rehabilitation team meets, so the physician, the case manager, the occupational therapist, the physical therapist, you know, and anyone else that may be involved. So typically when I say physician, I'm talking about a physiatrist or a rehab, you know, specialist, but they may also have orthopedic physicians involved. They may also have a psychologist or psychiatrist on the team. And that's becoming increasingly so. They may have a sex therapist on the team, a recreational therapist on the team. You know, that looks different depending on where you are. But the thing that often is not different is that they are meeting without you. And the degree to which you are participating in your treatment plan is minimal, okay? They tell you what you're doing every day, which, they're the experts. To some extent, that's, you know, to be expected. But they're also telling you when you're leaving, right? Discharge is not a mutually agreed upon solution oftentimes. And I realize I may be speaking out of both sides of my mouth. On the one hand, I'm saying that physicians, you know, shouldn't assume that the patient wants to be cured. On the other hand, though, I am saying that the person who knows the most about his or her body is the person whose body it is. And so these conversations shouldn't happen without physicians, certainly, but they also shouldn't happen without patients.
Very well said. Something I want to hear a little more about is the assumption that experiences of people with disability and disability itself offer no inherent value to society. I think it's a really toxic assumption and one that only amplifies the narratives of fear and stigma that prevent institutions from adapting to accommodate a diverse group of people, like we've discussed. Right now, I find myself at the risk of essentializing the experiences of those living with mobility impairments or who face a lack of accommodations, wondering how they have coped in times of extreme isolation. And people now are saying, when will we return to normal? And it's occurred to me that for some folks living with certain forms of disability, this normal that we may be calling for is more isolating than the status quo in which we are currently living, where we're all connected together in ways that are more accessible.
Very good point, Lefty.
in those times where you have been more isolated, what has been your experience, and how did you navigate, you know, building relationships and being who you want to be in the world during those times?
Yeah. I mean, that's really difficult. It's really difficult. And I think I'm glad you brought up the point of essentializing. I mean, I think it's important to realize, just like any other marginalized population, the disabled community is incredibly large, right? And we're talking about, I mean, broadly speaking, we're talking about three major, huge, very diverse groups of people. We're talking about people with sensory impairments, we're talking about people with mobility impairments, and we're talking about people with intellectual or cognitive impairments. And that, I mean, the needs of someone who has Down syndrome is very different than someone who has a spinal cord injury, which is very different from someone who is blind, deaf, hard of hearing, or hard of sight, or has impaired vision. I don't actually know if hard of sight is a real phrase, but I was going for parallelism, and then, you know, that endeavor failed. So anyway, the point I'm trying to make is, I think it's incredibly key not to essentialize. Now, I'm also, when I'm answering these questions, I'm also not going to subject everyone to a list of qualifications, right? Because anything I say could be qualified a million times over. I'm talking about my experience, and broadly, you know, I think what I'm saying has application for people with mobility impairments, but also, I mean, you know, it's not unrelated to people who have sensory or cognitive impairments too. But I will say, I mean, you know, those individuals experience a great deal of isolation as well. And you know, you can read, there are fantastic autobiographies and memoirs from people with those experiences. And that's really the best way to learn, right? Is to read writing, which also gets to one of the ways I think you can be alive in the world. I mean, I you know, I'm a writer, I'm a reader, I'm hoping to be a professional reader, which I realize is kind of a lucky experience. And one of the questions I get most when I talk about being a PhD student and talking about writing criticism and scholarship about poems that are not widely known anymore outside of certain circles, and I have the question, what does that matter? And I think it's a really good question. I mean, I you know, I'm not one of these humanists that's going to roll his eyes and say, oh, the, you know, the unwashed masses are wondering why literature art matters. Of course it matters. I mean, people since you know, the beginning of recorded human history, all across the world have been telling stories in some ways. We know that storytelling is important. That's not the issue. I think the issue now is, in a world where there's so much political turmoil, why read and why write versus practice medicine or practice law, which are incredibly important professions. And I'm so thankful that we have smart people doing it. But one of the answers to isolation is to write. One of the answers to isolation is to read. You learn about other mindsets. You get your voice out there, and you're reaching communities that you wouldn't ordinarily be able to reach. And I realize that when we're talking about disability, there are only, you know, certain people who maybe feel comfortable or are able to do that. I mean, reading and writing are not exempt from you know, ableist practices either, right? I'm not making that argument that this is a one-size-fits-all issue. But I am arguing that when I had my kneecap injury last year, I wrote two pieces from home. Actually, one of those pieces was co-written with Lexi. So if anyone wants to check it out, you should. It was about abortion disability and the co-opting of disability for the pro-life movement. But that was a way of communicating, and it was a way of breaking down barriers. And reading is a really important way of doing that too. I think the other thing, and this gets back to what I was saying about intimacy before and rethinking intimacy, is you have to be really proactive. You have to text people. You have to call people. Now, hopefully you have people in your life who are willing to support you regularly. And I'm very lucky to have Lexi as one of my best friends. I'm lucky to have a family who's prepared to do that. And so it's a two-way street. You've got to find quality people. But those quality people may not always understand what it's like to be in a sort of quasi-quarantine position. Now, that's not to say that many disabled people aren't out there exploring the world in all sorts of ways, right? And I think that's important too. We shouldn't think about the experience of disability as you know, conflating that with the old shut-in model of the 19, you know, turn of the century, let's say. But I think but oftentimes what I found is that intimacy does not come, platonic intimacy especially, does not come naturally to people. And you have to help them realize what it means to stay in contact on a regular basis.
I'd love, if you're willing, to dive deeper into this topic of platonic intimacy.
Yeah.
We've been talking about identity and its link to the roles society deems acceptable for certain people. Some of my male friends have expressed to me that intimate friendship is something they struggle with. When we've talked about the topic of vulnerability in the context of friendship, they've shared with me that forming close and vulnerable and platonic friendships with other men or women is something that hasn't been modeled well for them by other men, and something that society does not typically portray as a masculine activity. Although you've been a model for me as someone who embraces vulnerable friendship, I know that as a man, you've been subject to the same stereotypes that some of my male friends have encountered in their reflections on the friendships they keep. So I'd love to hear any reflections you have on these narratives of masculinity alongside all the things you've shared in these past minutes about your exploration and the importance of intimacy.
Yeah. And I think if I may, I'll connect this to the conversation we were having earlier about sort of the epistemology of disability, let's say. And so, you know, that's words like epistemology always sort of make me nervous. And I'm never quite sure how to use them, even though I'm supposed to be, you know, a theorist, I suppose. But let's just say, you know, call a spade and say the knowledge we can gain from being disabled, right? And this is, you know, the situatedness of disability yields certain insights, just like feminists have talked about standpoint theory, just like critical race theorists have talked about the sort of unique knowledge of inhabiting the world as a person of color. And I could go on and on. I mean, that's not to just prioritize those three groups, right? You know, Native scholars are thinking about it, queer and trans and intersex scholars are thinking about it. So, you know, so I don't mean to limit my answers or suggest that, you know, there's a certain sort of non-inclusivity going on here. I think one of the beauties of the epistemology of disability is that you learn that, you know, you learn the extent to which typical gender identities are predicated upon ability, right? And so for, you know, women, unfortunately, and this is incredibly upsetting, and it's why there's sometimes a bit of a friction between feminist and disability theory. You know, women and people who identify as female have traditionally been identified as sort of disabled. And this actually goes back to the classical period. And this is why it's so important to study literature to deal with any kind of social problem, right? And you know, this is another answer to why I study literature. But if you look at something like Aristotle's Generation of Animals, or if you look at something like Pliny the Elder's Natural Philosophy, or if you even look at one of the greatest poems in the English language, which of course is Paradise Lost by John Milton, you see these connections between disability and femininity. That's not the case, as Lexi just managed to say quite eloquently, for men and disability, right? Those two things have typically been seen as incongruous. Now, one of the great things about being disabled is you begin to see past these very facile combinations or very facile configurations of gender plus ability or disability. And of course, that's not the only way to think past these combinations, right? You know, there's much good work being done by male and female and you know, non-binary scholars on this front, right? I don't mean to limit this to disability theorists, but I think one of the things I've realized by being disabled is I can't possibly live up to those standards, right? I mean, the decision has been made for me, which is not to say, of course, that I was some macho, you know, jock before the accident. That wasn't the case. I always loved theater. I was never that good at sports except for tennis. I could go on and on. But it is to say that after the accident, the pretense is gone. You can just drop it. You can say to hell with it, because no longer can you possibly manage to hold yourself to those standards. And I think that has allowed me to be intimate with people and to accept the fact that all humans are needy. And so we might as well lean into it, and allowed me to see the way that we can begin, you know, picking apart these sorts of matrices of gender and ableist expectations.
Well, Pocky, thank you so much for sitting down with me and talking about all of these topics. I can't believe, but I'm not surprised that you were able to share so much wisdom in less than an hour. I feel so grateful to have you as a friend, as someone who I said I look up to, and someone who I continue to learn from every day.
Well, I feel the same way. And I, you know, I feel incredibly blessed to have you in my life. I learn, for anyone listening, I learn just as much, if not more, probably much more from Lexi than she learns from me. But I'm very appreciative of the time we had together today. And I hope we can continue these conversations, you know, beyond this podcast. I know Lexi and I certainly will, but I would love to talk to more of you too.
Yeah. And as a last thing, Pac, is there anything that you would want to say to people who are either in the midst of training to serve in a medical capacity or who are involved in medicine?
There is actually something I would like to say. And I'm going to preface this with a brief story, because I think it's really important. I mean, I think the one thing we didn't get to was, you know, what are the costs? I don't mean just monetary costs, although in the U.S. especially, monetary costs shouldn't be ignored, obviously. You all know that better than I do. But what are the costs of a lack of communication? I mentioned before that it's important to keep disabled people in the loop. It's important to keep patients in the loop. Now, even the term patient itself, I don't know who knows this or who would care to know it, but patient, the word patient comes from the Latin patior, which is I suffer, which is problematic in and of itself. I mean, that's a challenge, right? To think about the disabled person as, or the patient, someone in a medical sort of, who's the object of the medical gaze, let's say, in a kind of Foucauldian sense. It's problematic to think of that person as equivalent to the sufferer, right? Because we want to instill agency, we want to hand back empowerment to that person. But I think it's relevant, the etymological exercise, beyond just being fun, right? Etymology is a great laugh, but it's important because it throws light on the typical hierarchies and relationships that are regnant in the hospital, and it brings the pitfalls of that into light. So let me tell you a story. After my kneecap incident, I was walking along actually Stanford's campus. This is sort of ironic, given that I'm talking to a group of Stanford medical students, but I was visiting the campus as a possible grad school option, and I tripped on a paving stone, and I hurtled forward. And I should say that I fall about, I don't know, I mean, probably once every 6 weeks or so. So it's not that unusual of a situation. But what is unusual is to not be able to get up. And when I did try to get up, be in absolutely excruciating pain. Pain that probably rivaled being hit by a car, I have to say. And so, you know, immediately we call the paramedics. I look down. There is a piece of bone sticking up. Luckily, it was under my skin. But I suddenly had a huge hump in the middle of my leg. The top bit of the patella had migrated far upward. And thankfully, Lexi's parents were actually nearby. And so I was able to call them. And they came. My own parents were in Ohio, and they came out the next day. But the part of the story I really want to emphasize, I'm not going to regale you with all the, you know, travails of my poor kneecap, although I have a great scar to show for it, is that after the first surgery, there was very little communication. I saw the surgeon for about 7 minutes after my parents talked to him right after the surgery. I saw him later that night. And for the next couple of days, we had a string of residents and other, you know, sort of affiliated staff members on his team. And I think that's important, right? Stanford's a major education hospital, and that's great. I'm all for it. The problem is, along the way, we had a variety of terrible miscommunications. At one point, one PA tried to have me stand up shortly after my surgery, which was, again, an excruciating process. Another resident put the wrong brace on me and was going to have me start therapy with the wrong brace. And this is not to say that anyone's incompetent. I'm sure if they're working at Stanford, they're very, very bright, probably smarter than I. But it is to say that that the result of these mishaps, which could have really been devastating for someone without sort of the support and someone without sort of the know-how to manage the complicated moving pieces of the hospital, it could have been absolutely devastating. So I go into rehab, and after a week in on the acute floor, I go to a different rehab facility, and there I'm under the care of a physiatrist, two physiatrists, and, you know, of course, a number of rehab nurses and very kind, sweet people, and physical therapists, occupational therapists. And I started moving around, and I was so proud of myself. I could start lifting my leg up, and I could, you know, I didn't even have to use the leg lifter, and the nurses applauded me, and the physicians were saying I was doing so great, and I was making headway faster than anyone imagined. The only issue being that when I went back to the surgeon for my checkup, he said, "You haven't been activating your quads, have you?" And I said, "Well, no, of course not. I wouldn't do something that I'd been told not to do," when in fact, I have been doing that every time I lifted my leg. Every time I raised my leg into a position that was, you know, at an acute angle from the bed, or anytime I got up, anytime I tried to take a shower, I was doing just that. And the problem is that the doctor seemed to assume I knew that, but no one had communicated that to me. In fact, when they gave me the leg lifter to begin with, they said, "Here you go to use, so it won't be so painful for you to lift your leg up and down out of bed." And I thought, well, that's really nice. I appreciate the concern. But no one had communicated to me this was actually a necessary device. So what I had unwittingly did, and what the physiatrist at the rehab facility, and especially what many of the nurses and therapists who had watched me and encouraged me to do this, what we had all unwittingly did was re-break my kneecap. And the screws had come out. I mean, I literally, metaphor turned to reality. I had loose screws in my knee, and I had to have a second surgery. And luckily, my family is one that has very, very decent health insurance. And luckily, I'm in a position in my career where that was totally manageable. It was emotionally incredibly difficult. Lexi can attest to that fact. But it was absolutely and completely unnecessary. That was an unneeded development in my healing. And that unneeded development was due to the fact that from going to one institution to the other, the physicians had not communicated well, the physiatrists had not communicated well to the nurses, and no one had communicated very well to me. I mean, I'd like to think I'm a relatively competent individual that wouldn't have done something knowingly. So if someone had told me not to lift my leg rather than actively encouraged it, I think the process would have been sped up mightily. Now, that's important for a number of reasons. I mean, it's, you know, you don't want to be on pain medication longer than you have to. You certainly don't want to go, you don't want to be anesthetized for more often than you have to. And for someone with a bone density issue, you don't want to be non-weight bearing for longer than you have to. And certainly I wanted to get back to Oxford. I don't share this with you to grouse, although it maybe you can tell from the tone and timbre of my voice that it's hard for me to relay this without grousing a little bit, but I do emphasize going back to this idea of patients as integral parts of their management and treatment teams. Communication is important. Disabled individuals are not children, although even children obviously should be included in their own healing. But disabled individuals are not children. They're not somehow lesser than. They're not more incompetent for the fact that somewhere along the line they develop some kind of chronic illness or other sort of impairment, right? There's no shame attached to it. And in many cases, they're just as smart as their physicians. Now, that's not to say that people or I are as smart as you guys who are in one of the best medical schools in the country, but it is to say that the more minds you have working on a particular issue, the better it is. And I could give you all kinds of theoretical talk about models of disability and talking about self-esteem and talking about how we theorize disability as an epistemological resource. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, for what you all are doing, for all the great work you're doing, that's to some extent hogwash, right? I mean, you're not going to walk into a hospital room and tell someone, "I want to help you understand the epistemology of disability." That would be ridiculous. But what I do think you're in a unique, quote-unquote, asterisk, unique situation a unique position to accomplish is to help people realize that they are not just sufferers. They are agents, and they are people with in a unique sort of situation that can impact their lives in a number of ways. And it doesn't that impact doesn't necessarily have to be life ending, right? And so I think that is the anecdote, and that's the message I would want to leave you with today.
Thank you for sharing that powerful anecdote and for offering that very valuable advice, Pocky. And again, thank you very much for taking the time to chat with me this afternoon and to share your phenomenal insights so generously with me and with anyone else that takes a listen to this. I'm very grateful.
Thank you so much, and I would be happy to continue these conversations with anyone who'd be interested to.
Thank you again to Pocky Toscano for being willing to be interviewed for this podcast. Music used in this episode is by the artist Yo-Yo Ma. I hope that if you listened to this podcast, you found Pocky's insights as valuable as I did. Thank you for taking the time to listen, and feel free to share this podcast with anyone else you think might be interested as well.